There is a line in this article that, out of context, sounds absolutely ridiculous and brilliant. And they wrote, and I'm just going to quote it, "He runs investigation agency GSI Paranormal West Yorks with partner Shane Corbett, with the duo using microphones and cameras to look around the castle." Why didn't they just use their eyes? And welcome to episode 17 of the Spooktator podcast. This is the podcast that looks back at paranormal stories in the news from the past month and explores them in more detail than they probably deserve. You can find the links for all of the stories we discuss in this episode at spooktator.co.uk. My name is Hayley Stevens, and joining me for this episode are Charlie Revel-Smith.
Evening, everyone.
Paul Gannon.
Hello.
And Alistair Coleman.
Hello there.
Firstly, a huge thank you to everyone who watched our live broadcast for episode 16 last month. It was great fun to do, and I hope everyone enjoyed it as much as we did. If you didn't catch it, it's available to watch on our website. Now, since then, have you guys been up to anything interesting?
I have fulfilled a lifetime ambition this week.
Oh.
Yes.
Yes,
you may know me as the person who runs Angry People in local newspapers, and for the first time ever, I have been an angry person in a local newspaper.
Oh, what?
You look proper angry as well. It was great.
Proper angry. Picture of me pointing angrily at some stuff left around a bin. Big thanks to the Fleet News and Mail for accommodating me. And you can see it on the Get Hampshire Co. UK website if you feel like it.
Alistair, does that mean you're going to put it on your own website and then do this recursive hall of mirrors?
It's on there.
Yes, it is, yes.
Excellent.
You can go to Facebook and search for angry people in local newspapers and you will find my furry fizzle pointing angrily and you will love it or hate it.
Oh, no, it was a work of art.
It was a piece of artistic genius.
I've now got the taste for it and I want to do it again. I'm going to be like going around Fleet and North Hampshire pointing at things now until they tell me to sod off.
I really like that there was a quote in there because obviously it was about nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas, and there was a quote in there saying this is no laughing matter, and I actually laughed out loud at that. That was very good.
Thank you, I wrote that.
That was very good.
Now, we hadn't planned to discuss this story, but I keep finding myself drawn back to it. So sorry, guys, I haven't forewarned you. But I thought, why the hell not? I'll just go for it. Have you guys seen the ghost hunter who claims that a ghost beard manifested on his face during a ghost hunt?
I did see that story, yes, and just thought, in one word, bollocks.
No, it was beard. It has the most incredible headline, and I'm just going to read it out loud. Well, that would actually help, wouldn't it? Because this is a podcast. I'm just going to read it out in full, is what I meant. Right, here is the headline, which I now have oversold, but I'm going to go for it anyway. Clean-shaven ghost hunter claims the spirit of one of William the Conqueror's favourite barons gave him a haunted beard during an investigation of a 14th century castle. Yes, a ghost hunter claims, and the article in the Daily Mail goes on to say, a ghost hunter claims the spirit of one of William the Conqueror's favourite barons haunted them during the investigation of a castle, giving him a medieval-style beard in an eerie photo. I don't think the word eerie is used accurately at all.
Yeah.
Andrew Alexander was investigating the 14th century castle in North Yorkshire when colleague Julie Cockcroft took a photo of him. But the team was stunned to find that despite being clean shaven that morning, Mr. Alexander appeared to have a full grey pointed beard in the spooky snap. The father of three believes the beard to be similar to that of William de Percy, a Norman nobleman who arrived in Britain shortly after the conquest of 1066, and is thought to have built the manor house that was the foundations for the castle. Mediums have since told him the beard is a manifestation of Percy, taking the use of Mr. Alexander's face to show he is there, guarding the castle still hundreds of years later. Now, I have several problems with this story already.
Sorry. just several.
why, if you were a ghost and you could manifest, why would you manifest as a beard when that's open to subjective speculation? Like, is it a beard? Is it not a beard?
Is it just certain types of hair that manifest themselves? I mean, it could be chest hair. I mean,
but how? Yeah. Hair isn't really alive, is it, as such? It's just like keratin tendrils, right? So how does hair have a ghost?
Well, in a way, it's how do...
Well, then how do ghosts have clothes?
Exactly.
Yeah, and how do ghosts have bodies to begin with? How does any of it work? Once you start getting into whether you can have a haunted beard, then you actually opening a whole can of worms as far as how can ghosts have anything at all.
I mean, there are naked ghosts. I think there have been reports of naked ghosts, because I once asked this question trying to be clever, and Christian Jensen Roma came back and was like, well, actually, there are all these accounts of naked ghosts, as he would, because he knows everything there is to know about ghosts. But I digress. There are still various questions about a ghost beard that just don't make sense. And also, how effective does this ghost think it is to guard a castle as a beard? Because that's the idea behind it, is that he's guarding, the spirit is guarding the castle, but I don't think he's doing a very effective job.
For me, it's the logic jump between having an image of yourself where you think you've got a beard to suddenly proclaiming it's the ghost of some dead god. You know, it's like, what train of thought did he go from, that picture's a bit funny, to, it's obviously me defending this dead old building?
Oh, there's more detail. The piece continues. Mr. Alexander said, after getting the image of me with the beard, sorry, we looked up the original owner of the castle who built it. I was shocked to see he had a small beard like this one.
Wow.
My God, that proves it.
I was pretty amazed when I realised this. People reckon it's a manifestation trying to use my face to show he is there. I was shocked when I saw, as I was completely clean-shaven, I always am after being in the army. Right. The picture was taken by Mr. Alexander's colleague, Julie Cockcroft, who said there is so much that goes unexplained at the castle. And she goes on to say, a sceptic will say it's the camera or shadows or some stubble that has suddenly shown up. Yes, Julie, we will.
Yes.
Too bloody right we would.
No, it's just a shadow, isn't it?
It's pixelation and a shadow, and it's basically the photo is taken in poor conditions, and it probably hasn't been set up for the conditions that the photo was taken in, and it's caused this oddity in the photo. And for some reason, they've decided that it's a beard.
Yeah, I'm with the whole ghost fucking with us theory. I mean, you're dead, you're bored, you're dead bored. What are you going to do? Oh, I'm just going to appear as a beard. That would be good for a laugh. And all your other ghosty shows go, yeah, yeah, you do that. It will get us in the papers and everything. Sorted.
This brings it to a point that at some point in our future, I'd like us to get more into detail with. What makes this news? You know, where? How does this become news? Is it possible that we between us can try and get a fake haunting into the newspaper and see how quickly it's snatched?
Oh, I would love to try that.
No, we can, because this is the root. This is the origin. This is the basically, if they don't do their research and listen to this podcast, then they have obviously slipped up.
Yeah, there's no time to double check anything. I think you're right, yes.
Can I confess to something now? I think
you've done this before, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, I have. I think enough water's passed under the bridge to confess that we once... me and my very best friend cut out the shape of a flying saucer, stuck it on a window behind some net curtains, took a really bad photograph, and then sold it to a local newspaper. Who bought?
Part of me just really wants to have a crack at this and see how far it can go. Not to the point where, like, it's like that Canadian experiment that the film The Quiet Ones was based on, where a bunch of psychologists create a ghost and then get haunted by it. I'm not suggesting we go mad. I'm just suggesting that maybe one of us... suggests a haunting, comes up with a shitty photograph or shitty evidence, tries to get it printed and see how far it goes. Because then, if they don't listen back to this podcast, if someone doesn't go, for example, oh, let's check into Hayley, see who she is, listen back to this podcast and finds us talking about this right now, then that's their problem.
Well, I think if they Google my name and ghosts, they're going to probably find my blog on which I debunk ghosts on a routine basis and go, hang on, this is rather weird.
In this case, I'll do it.
Now, a still from a video has emerged from a ghost hunt in Maine that is alleged to show a ghostly apparition. Charlie, can you tell us more?
I can, and this is when I need my theme music. I'm going to loosely put in the category of my ongoing investigation into celebrity ghosts. It's kind of stretching the term celebrity, I think, because she isn't really known at all outside of that specific theatre. But she was a stage singer who in 1904, the day before Halloween, she allegedly collapsed and died on stage while singing. What was the song that she was singing? Goodbye, Little Girl, Goodbye. She was singing while her 3-year-old daughter was in the audience watching her. Such is the story. And in truth, it seems most theatres do enjoy to have a bit of mystery, and ghosts seem to be very, very common in those kind of places. But this story is of a photograph which was taken from, well, a single image which was taken from a piece of video that was supposedly recorded back in December. But there is a tiny bit of controversy about that, which I'll come to later. But this single frame on this video seems to show a ghostly woman climbing a staircase in the theatre. And I don't know if any of you have seen the photograph itself. But as far as ghost photos go, I find it one of the, it's definitely in the better half of the ones that we've looked into here before, in as much as that I can at least make out a human figure, which in the past I've struggled to sometimes. I think this is actually, it's certainly not a convincing picture, but it is better than the standard of some of them which we're able to actually get in the papers. First of all, the actual story of Eva Gray herself, there doesn't seem to be an awful amount of historic evidence to back up the story of it actually happening, of her dying on the stage and things like that. It could be a case of she was a singer who died and it was, she possibly didn't die under those circumstances. With time, it's just become more elaborated, and the story's become a bit more tragic. They've sort of added more levels to it. But this was taken, as I said, supposedly last month by EVP Paranormal Maine, who were investigating the theatre at the evening. There were a team of, I think it was 4 investigators went in there and locked off certain parts of the theatre with infrared cameras, and then went back later to look over the footage that they'd taken, which is where supposedly that they actually spotted this strange sort of seeming ghost on the staircase there. Now, one of the big things which I always think is a red flag about when you see that zoomed in and enlarged image is when you go back and you look at the original image that was taken, the original still from the video, and it's a much, much wider shot, which has now been zoomed in and zoomed in and zoomed in to quite an extreme amount before you can actually see the figure on the staircase. Quite a small figure, actually. People have estimated that she might not be much more than 18 inches tall. But as soon as you do that, what you actually end up looking at is quite a lot of digital artifacts and essentially pixels that you're seeing of where the camera's actually struggled to have entire clarity of an area. It's done almost like a best guess of what that area is supposed to be at that kind of that sort of intensity of closeness. And artifacts and digital images are notoriously tricky because it can be something as simple as a piece of dust in the air in the foreground. So looking through this, I was like, well, it looks like it could be digital artifacts. It could be a touch of pareidolia mixed in there as well, because an awful lot of ghost photographs, I think, before you go for the idea of it being a hoax, then you can actually say it's more likely actually a mistake, that it's just an oddity on there. But so I was quite happy with that, thinking, yeah, that seems like a fairly rational explanation for it, sort of like case unsolved in as much as you can never know for sure. But there was a tiny little bit of a twist in as much as, I don't know if any of you read the, like a follow-on article about this, about the theatre at the time. Well, there has been just a small bit of controversy about whether they actually were there on at the time when they said that they were. And as soon as I think that a paranormal team starts maybe being loose with the facts or trying to be a bit more sensationalist, it does call into question their whole credibility of it. But in this case, it sounds like they genuinely were there at the time. It was a bit of a miscommunication between the theatre owners and the people who were looking after it on that evening. And it seems much more likely that the footage of the marquee outside was just taken at a different occasion. And the actual investigation in the night did genuinely go ahead. And which means that although that there have been, I think it was the artistic director's daughter actually suggested that they faked it and they weren't there on the evening. I think that by accounts from other people, they were actually in there in the evening. I don't think that it needs to be faked in order for something like this to have happened. I think that a lot of people get into their heads that it's either real or it's a hoax. And I think there's actually a lot more to it usually than that. And it's actually misunderstandings or people not entirely understanding how their equipment works. It seems much more likely to be the explanation which I would put forward for this. But I like the photo. I like the photo. I think it's a nice one. It looks like a beautiful theatre. And it's actually a bit of a higher standard than the ones that we usually see.
I don't know. There's a really good follow-up to this story over at Doubtful News, written up by Sharon Hill, who's done some research into the whole thing. There is on the Doubtful News site, which we'll link to from our website, spooktator.co.uk, there is a side-by-side comparison of the ghost photo, the zoomed-in version, which has been passed around in the media, and next to it, what I believe is a still from a news report. There's a screen. Yes, I had. I quote here. I had to take a screenshot of the reporter when he was on the lowest step. So he's basically on the same staircase this ghost was photographed on, and he's probably what, 6 foot, average 6 foot, and he takes up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 steps. Essentially, when he's on the bottom step, that's how tall he is. And the ghost takes up 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe. So it really is very, very small in comparison.
I had a look at images of the staircase elsewhere online, and usually when you go into theatres, they have quite shallow steps, as you could imagine, because when you have a large crowd of people, you don't want them all going up or down steep staircases, because it can be dangerous. So it tends to be quite a steady climb. So each of the steps is quite small, and the staircase itself is quite deep. So the average person standing at the bottom actually would appear to be a lot taller than that. This would be a really tiny, tiny ghost that we'd be looking at. Any other theatre which had the ghost of a child would probably be happier with that footage. But obviously, this is supposed to be Eva Grey that they're suggesting.
There's even some contention about whether or not she actually died on the stage. There aren't any documentations or news clippings that have been found. And so Sharon Hill says, and you know, I think justifiably, that it's one of those theatre legends, and pretty much every theatre has a legend of somebody dying or somebody still haunting the place.
Yes, and it just becomes the mythology of the place with time, and it doesn't matter if there was no record of her dying on stage.
No, exactly. But I found quite interesting, because they covered it on a website called journaltribune.com as well. And on there it mentioned, and I'm not going to say their whole name, I'm just going to call them EVP. This team EVP completed its 2.5 hour investigation. So they only spent 2.5 hours there.
That's not long, is it?
It's really not long. It's not long enough to establish what is and isn't normal in a location. Any investigator, you know, worth their weight will basically spend a long time at a location establishing what's normal before being able to then claim something is abnormal. And this report also has a photo of what they claim is a man sitting on one of the it looks like a mezzanine area, and there's allegedly a man sitting there, but it's just some kind of pixelation and
it's like a little smeary blob kind of.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
It's. I just think this group are clutching at straws, really.
As a former technician, one of the things that does crop up every now and then is the shape of the iris of the camera, and they do stretch to funny long or diamond shapes. It depends on the quality of the camera, depends on the light levels, whereupon it actually will focus on the iris itself and produce the shape of a light that may look something like that. It's a classic in UFO photos.
Alistair, can you tell us why a Leeds corner shop suddenly has paranormal investigators in a flurry?
Yes, this is another one we're going to be looking at what some people might call past life, some people might call deja vu, but it's comes from 1998, but has just appeared in the Yorkshire Evening Post this month. It's about a ghost hunter trying to trace back some sisters after a haunted encounter in a local newsagent. So here we are in Leeds. Well, I'm not in Leeds, I'm in Hampshire. Here, the story's in Leeds. And it opens up with the question, strong top line here. Are you a woman called Mandy who had a ghostly encounter in a Leeds paper shop back in 1998? Yeah, so here we are. I'm going to quote wildly from here because it is quite an interesting story. A paranormal investigator is trying to trace a witness to a haunting time slip incident in a newsagent who posted about her experience on a USA website. The woman, who gave her name as Mandy on the forum, describes in detail the strange encounter she had in her local shop in the summer of 1998. She'd been walking to work with her sister when the pair decided to call into the newsagent in an unspecified area of Leeds. They were standing outside a newsagent's and they could see through the glass that it was quite busy inside. But as one of the two sisters walked in, she apparently walked right through a woman who was looking at a magazine. And only then did my sister stop and ask, says the item. What woman? Ooh. And I walked in ahead of my sister and turned to her and said, I just think I've seen a spirit. You just walked through this woman. But it was like one person looking through the window and thinking they'd seen somebody standing there and somebody actually walking into the shop and not walking for anybody at all because it was just a reflection from somewhere else. But hey...
Yeah, that seems like a very easy explanation for that one.
Yes, for a 19-year-old mystery that's made it into a regional newspaper two decades later. It's an awful lot of an easy explanation. But is it, really? I mean... Deja vu is a powerful thing to some people, or seeing time slips is a powerful thing to some people. So I mean, it could be something psychological here. It could be something that's not been remembered very well, which is always a danger in these sort of research things.
And people elaborate things as they remember them as well, become more dramatic with time.
They've even made a big thing about the shop building dates from 1899.
Yeah, but most things date from 1899, don't they?
Yeah, that's not all that impressive, really.
But have you ever experienced a time slip or deja vu? I had deja vu 2 days ago when we were moving some furniture around in our house, and we just got a new hi-fi. And we had some music playing on the hi-fi, really loud. And I was overcome with the sensation of deja vu. And I looked up to my brother's girlfriend who was helping me move something. And I said to her, we need to turn the music down because the neighbours are going to come around and complain. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I just know that if we don't turn the music down, they'll come around and complain. I'm having deja vu. And we turned the music down because I felt like, that any moment they were going to come around and knock on the door. And because of that sensation, we turned the music down. It was really weird because afterwards I was like, what am I doing?
It is a really powerful experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it to do with your brain's concept of the passage of time, that what you've just seen a second ago, it for some reason, it's almost filing it away in long-term memory rather than immediate.
It's just a little sort of an error in the way, in kind of memory storage, for want of a better term.
Yeah, it's kind of like memory pareidolia, where I think it's something to do with your brain goes, this seems familiar, and associates it with a feeling or an experience you had that was very similar, and then says it's the same thing.
There was some research last year that, well, it was published last year, and I think the researchers, they scanned the brains of volunteers after they were given triggers to bring about the sensation of deja vu, and they discovered that it was something to do with the brain basically checking the memories were correct, and so they suggested that deja vu is like a conscious awareness of a discrepancy in memory signals being correct, and so the brain is trying to correct that, and it's not because a lot of people thought it was something to do with a mental health issue, or like maybe something wrong with your brain, like Alzheimer's or something like that, but it's not, it's something to do with
I've heard people suggesting that it could even be connected to stroke and things like that, but I don't think that there is much evidence behind it, other than just because stroke is associated with an awful lot of really bizarre things which can go wrong with your brain.
Yeah, because it's like suddenly you're very, very switched on and really aware when you weren't before. But I think basically the studies that were published last year suggested it's not an error, but the brain preventing an error. So there was nothing really to worry about.
I did hear a really good story about a guy who had a time slip. It was on a podcast. I forget the name of the podcast now, but I know it was one of Kevin Smith's podcast channels, and I can't remember which particular one it was. But this guy told a story about, they were interviewing this guy who claims to be an expert and a ghost historian or whatever, and he was saying basically his story was that he was coming home from school, he was walking up the lane, and then as he got closer and closer to what he thought was the end of the road, it was stretching out in front of him, and the next minute he knew he'd lost an hour and was like a mile behind where he'd set off from, and his mum picked him up saying, I just had this weird voice in my head saying you'd be here, so I came and collected you, and you were here. And that was his story.
That's a lot of the story with alien abductions, how it begins, isn't it, with that missing time. I know that it was at the Bette and Barney Hill story from 1966, I think it was. They were driving home, and I think they realised that they got home and they had missing time, which they didn't know where it had actually gone. And it was only later then that they started seeing some somewhat inscrupulous hypnotherapists and general therapist who seemed to have implanted ideas in their head that were a lot more interesting than perhaps might have actually been the case of what happened.
I remember growing up that I must have read it in a local folklore book or something. I remember it stuck with me for a long time, that somebody driving through Avebury, anyone who's never been to Avebury, you drive through it, and the stone circles are on either side
of
the road.
You drive right through the stone circle, don't you?
Yeah, it's brilliant. And they were driving through, and they thought it was really weird because there was like a medieval fair happening like to the side. And they wanted to stop, but they couldn't because they had to be somewhere. And then when they got home, they looked up what had happened, what they'd missed, and there was nothing advertised. And so they went back to the Red Lion, which is the pub that sits in the middle, and they were like, what was with the medieval fair, and the Red Lion owners didn't know what they were talking about, and that was concluded to have been a time slip.
Can I tell you my favourite one? This was on a website, and I read it a few years ago. It was about a guy who was a plumber, and he was trying to fix something under the sink, and he crawled through under the sink and then crawled through a time tunnel, and apparently met himself in the future as an old man and took a selfie with him where he showed off his tattoos. Seriously, if you look online, you'll probably find it, but apparently that's proof that he went through a time tunnel and met himself and took a selfie, and they looked the same, and one was older, and they both had the same tattoo.
That happens to all of us.
Oh, I've just Googled it, and the title is, Did This Man Find a Wormhole Under His Kitchen Sink?
No.
I always like the Percy Shelley story, that he supposedly, as a young man, saw himself drowning in the sea, and apparently that he did end up drowning in the that's how we lost Percy Shelley, apparently.
Now, if you go down to the woods today, you're in for a big surprise. But it's nothing to do with a teddy bear picnic, is it, Paul?
Unfortunately not, no. This story comes from stokesenatal.co.uk. It's called Paranormal Investigator Takes on the Werewolf of Cannock Chase. Cannock Chase, one of the alleged hotspots of supernatural activity in the UK, is now, along with all the other things it apparently has, like a UFO, a weird cat of some kind, a slender man, black-eyed children, goblins probably, but it now has a werewolf, and that's because a chap called Damon Sims, he was contacted by a production company who was interested in making a TV show called The Werewolf of Cannock Chase. He also writes an article called Supernatural Staffordshire, which is him writing apocryphal stories where no one is named and all the stories are apparently very true. You know what I mean? Where like he goes, here's a story I was told by my man in Gloucester, and there's no name, there's no age, there's no street, there's no nothing. It's just a story that he decides to tell and calls it a news story. So he writes that on a regular basis. He says in this article, I see the werewolf of Cannock Chase as a rather fantastic cash cow. Already my interest in the story stopped there. Because frankly, the minute you start looking at something like this as a story and go, my first chain of thought is to go, oh, this is a great way of making money and maybe promoting a book and getting on TV and talking to other newspapers. I kind of zone out. Because surely your first question is not how much money can I make, but how much bollocks is this?
Well, most investigators at least try and pretend to be a bit more altruistic than that. I was quite surprised about how blunt he was in saying that it was a potential cash cow. He's probably right. Yeah. There probably is money to be made from promoting a werewolf.
I'd like to point out here, as a student of the local newspaper, that the whole Daily Mail has a pet werewolf, which appears every now and then.
When you say that it appears now and then, do you mean like every full moon?
It's appeared about two or three times in the last year.
Every time there's a full moon?
Yeah, probably every full moon, yeah. Yeah, there's somebody running around the local bogs, the canals, who's a werewolf. But yeah, so I wouldn't put it past other newspapers to want a bit of that spooky lycanthrope action.
Yeah, well, werewolves are all the popular trend these days, I believe, because vampires are out, werewolves are in.
Yeah, werewolves should be back in. I think they need... I was actually thinking about this today. I reckon, sort of film for film, there's a higher percentage of good werewolf films than there are vampire films.
Yeah. No, yeah. And isn't there going to be, like, another version of in the Shadow? What was it called? What We Do in the Shadows?
Oh, What We Do in the Shadows. Yeah, Werewolves is coming out. Yes, that was such a great film. It was. I would say Ginger Snaps is my recommendation for werewolf film. It's so good, isn't it?
I also highly...
What a script that thing has.
I also highly recommend The Howling, the original, Joe Dante. Yeah. Very good.
And American Werewolf in London.
Oh, absolutely.
I was just about to say that, yes, a true classic, which I have not seen in years.
The thing is with the werewolf in Cannock Chase is that it actually isn't a new thing. So it's not like Damon Sim has come along and gone, do you know what we need as a werewolf? That I think the first sighting, or one of the first sightings, dates back to the 1970s.
Yeah, it mentions that story in here, because the chain of events must have been, here's a TV company trying to make something for Sky Arts, probably. They approach him because he lives local and writes about this kind of stuff, and he's gone, oh, ka-ching. He says... it's the actual story he mentions in the news article on the website says, I found a story of a boy in Eccleshaw who promised his soul to the devil in exchange for being able to transform into a werewolf whilst using a Ouija board.
Hang on, he found a boy. Like, he actually found a boy.
Yeah, the devil was grooming a boy and handing out...
And Damon Sim found him.
No, he found the story of a boy in Eccleshaw.
Oh, okay, sorry.
That's all right. He found a story of the boy in Eccleshaw who sold his soul to the devil in so he could be a werewolf. Shortly after, he rang up a friend making strange guttural noises. Again, not Damon, the boy in the story. was panicking about transforming. He then committed suicide and he stabbed himself with a silver knife. It was about the time of the first sighting of the werewolf that was made in 1975.
I hate it when boys phone me up making guttural noises and then stab themselves to death.
Yeah, they're creepy phone calls. He was contacted. This is Damien now, not the boy. God, I need to clarify this now. You stupid bastards. He was contacted by a production company called 11 Films. They're working on a new paranormal TV show, and they approached me after reading my Supernatural Staffordshire article column to ask if I could help pulling together a show about the werewolf. And then he goes into talking about the UFOs, the Black Eyed Children, and the Pigman and the Lady of the Chase. And then there's that horrible picture of every Black Eyed Child that every website tends to use, of the old Victorian image with an obviously photoshopped picture of a demon's face on the front. So that's where that starts.
Now, let's discuss this. I think we need to discuss this. I think it's like the elephant in the room, because Cannock Chase is always in the news, okay? It's an odd place. It's basically 26 square miles of thick woodland in the Staffordshire area, and it's notorious because in the 1960s, the bodies of three children were discovered buried there. They'd been murdered by Raymond Leslie Morris, and this was dubbed the Cannock Chase Murders. But it's not the fact that it's like an area of natural beauty or the notorious crimes that attract the most attention. It's this weird paranormal history and notoriety, because, you know, just a quick rundown reveals the amount of weird shit happening in that area, allegedly. It's claimed that in the 1960s, a UFO crashed there, or part of a UFO crashed there, and was covered up by NATO and the British forces. People also claim that there's secret government work going on, which resulted in a human-pig hybrid called the Pigman. There are thousands of reports of sightings of ABCs, which are alien big cats, which are basically out of place large black cats like panthers. Other out of place animals said to frequent the woodlands include wild boar, kangaroos, massive snakes, and at one point a giant crocodile. Not to mention the spectral black dogs, or grims or shucks as they're often known, plus all the ghosts, the weird light phenomena, and the phantoms said to haunt the woods and the roads. In 2005, it was said that a Bigfoot-type creature had been seen around the chase by several eyewitnesses. An earlier sighting of that creature was made in 1879, when a creature described as being half man, half monkey was seen on the road near Cannock Chase. And there were other sightings of Bigfoot through the 1900s too. There are claims that dark rituals take place in the chase under the cover of darkness, which are satanic. There are recent claims, as we very well know, that Slender Man and even Black Eyed Kids haunt the chase. And, of course, as Paul has already mentioned, there is a werewolf as well. And what really interests me, obviously I'm interested in the phenomena. If there is any, you know, actual phenomena occurring, that interests me. What's causing it? Why is it happening? But more, the thing that interests me more is how Cannock Chase seems to be this magnet for people like Damon Sim, and who go there to investigate this weird stuff. There's a book by There's a book by a guy called Lee Brickley which promotes the legends in Cannock Chase called UFOs, Werewolves and the Pigman, Exposing England's Strangest Location, Cannock Chase. And before that, Nick Redfern has written about it in a number of his books. But his books tend to be quite interesting. They may not be accurate, but they tend to be quite interesting because that's what Redfern does. But Lee Brickley's book was pretty awful. I reviewed it back in 2013. I reread my review ahead of this episode, and I was really mean in it, didn't I? But I think justifiably so. I wrote in the review, Brickley states he believed that the odd things occurring in the area are possibly caused by an interdimensional portal, and that a series of animal mutilations, for which a culprit was never found, were possibly the result of alien visitors. In another instance, Brickley doesn't consider whether it's possible for werewolves to exist at all, but instead whether it's possible for them to manifest during daylight, and asserts that people who claim to have seen monsters passed polygraph tests, so they must be telling the truth. Now, I think that speaks to, the kind of the level of seriousness with which Lee Brickley.
Well, at this point, I would like to say I did read your open letter to Lee on your website, and found that fascinating. especially his response to you, where, if you don't mind me reading out his response, that tickled me, because you put together a really thoughtful piece about how you thought the ethics of what he was doing and the way he was doing them were at odds with proper paranormal investigation. That was simply it. And he wrote, "Dear Miss Stevens, I didn't take the time to read past the first paragraph of your letter because your opinions matter little to me. I do, however, find it fascinating that you're so obsessed with everything I do. With great respect." When someone says that, you know they're about to call you a knob, right? I mean, "With great respect, you continue doing what you're doing, and I'll do the same. I do not need advice from someone from the likes of you. No matter how many times you try to offer it, I will continue to ignore your efforts. I will research in the manner I see fit, and if the media chooses to pick it up on my work, so be it. Enjoy your bitterness and jealousy towards me. I do. Good day. P.S. I will not be checking back to see your reply, so rant as much as you like. You are insignificant to my research."
That means I will be checking back.
That's me told.
Hourly.
He makes it sound like I stalked him. I didn't. Seriously, I didn't. But he was the first, wasn't he, of many investigators who have basically been drawn to the area. We've covered stories in recent episodes of people standing in the woodlands there going, "Did you hear that?" There was a story in, I did the five worst ghosts of 2016. There was a Cannock Chase story in that. In fact, I think Cannock Chase has featured probably in all of the top five worst ghosts I've done since 2011. It's that prominent. And it really interests me, because what is it that attracts these people to the area to investigate things that are really old, like, you know, too old to properly investigate now by any rate? And I don't like to cast people into stereotypes, because I think it's degrading and harmful. But the fact is they all tend to be men between their 30s and 50s. Which is really striking, and it makes me wonder if a lot of people are creating a sort of character for themselves that's maybe a deep contrast to their regular day-to-day lives. I really don't know.
I think that's definitely what it is. I just think, this is a very arrogant and probably snobbish way, and I don't like talking about things like this, because when I was doing ghost hunting for the research of my solo show, I met people of all shapes and sizes, colours and creeds who do this for all various reasons. However, it seems that the people who run this tend to be people who have not done much of their lives, discovered it quite late and gone, "I can be an expert at this, and that's my raison d'etre now. That is kind of what I do. I don't really need to know how all this stuff works, but I need to sound like I know what I'm talking about."
Incidentally, the story I covered about EVP Paranormal Maine, as far as I could tell, entire women on the team. So, yeah. But it was only noticeable because it's not that common. That it did seem a rarity that you'd have an entire paranormal investigating team of women. It definitely is much more a male pursuit for some reason.
I don't know that it is. This is the thing, because many studies about paranormal belief and associated things have always shown that women are more likely to believe in superstition and paranormal ideas. And that isn't to say women are stupider. I think it's just always been more acceptable for women to talk about having these beliefs. And obviously now men are probably also feel now in contemporary society feel more able to talk about these beliefs too. But ghost hunting always seems to have been more women than men to me. But it always seems that when it comes to media coverage, that men tend to dominate. And they always do so in a way where they're wearing, like, you know, those vests that people wear when they go, like, running or when they go fishing and they've got lots of pockets for all their gadgets and so on. Adventurer clothing, like something like Bear Grylls would wear. They always wear that, and they always kind of do these poses. And it's,
I think,
like,
it might be something of a tech element involved with that as well. That
maybe
that it is.
It's the modern day fishing.
Yeah, possibly. Yes.
And as the joke I used to make in my solo show was, fishing and ghost hunting are very similar. They both involve sitting around for hours doing nothing and then lying about what you caught.
Hey.
Very good.
But I mean, the thing is, when I was doing psychic and science, I would say 80% of the audience were female, you know, and I don't know if it's a male thing to just kind of go, "I want to be the expert in this," and so
it
therefore
might,
they'll take
it. It might also be a sort of a damning indictment on our press as well, that in looking for a voice which they imagine to have authority to be talking, they might be looking out for men in the first place, thinking that our tabloid press especially does not take seriously the voices of women, as controversial a thing as that may seem to be to say.
Are you saying it's fake news? Post-truth fake news?
Dun, dun, dun. No, I think you're absolutely spot on with that, to be honest. And the response that I got from Lee Brickley to my open letter to him. The reason I wrote that, by the way, is because I mentioned previously the murders, the Cannock Chase murders, when the black-eyed kids started making the headlines because of Lee Brickley. The newspapers were suggesting that they could be the unrestful spirits of the murder victims. And I basically reached out to say, that's really unethical. You can't
start
linking
completely tasteless.
But he's changed his story, though, now, hasn't he? Because he says now there's something to do with some kind of cult that existed there a long time ago. In this article in the Birmingham Mail that you mentioned, I think he goes on to say that it's got something to do with Cornovi, a Celtic tribe known for their blood sacrifices. That's his story now for the Black Eyed Children, because it's probably a lot less offensive. And I do wonder as well, are these stories of Cannock Chase accelerated since his interest in the area has become, you know, something he can sell? I mean, I don't know if it's been consistent or whether it's been exaggerated and far more condensed and focused now.
There can be a degree to which it just becomes self-perpetuating after a while, though, that all you need to do is start the rumours in the first place, and then it just escalates all by itself. And especially as this seems to be, like, you get a bit of absolutely anything here, so you can put down anything which is seen as slightly out of the ordinary as give it a paranormal explanation behind it. Places like this, they become famous for it, so therefore it attracts the kind of people researching it, so they come up with claims of things, and then that becomes part of the mythology, and it just goes on and on and on, and I think it becomes unstoppable after a while.
He seems to be making creepypasta part of heritage.
So yeah, once it hits the front page of, not naming names here, the Daily Star, it's always going to remain on the front page because they found it's good value for a good story which sells extra papers. It's good copy. That's why you get so many on the front page of the Star.
But then that's why when the Black Eyed Children thing appeared on the front page of the Sun and then was on This Morning and things like that as well. It's like, that's when it blows my mind. That's when it's kind of like, why is this news? Why has this become a talking point when obviously all they've done is reported creepypasta as if it's actually local legend? And it's not. He talks about the Slender Man as well taking place in Cannock Chase, a phenomenon that was generally created on the internet.
Yeah, just entirely internet-based, that we can track it down to the absolute earliest roots of it being completely internet-based phenomenon.
There's a documentary out this year all about the Slender Man in terms of how it started and it led to that, you know, that stabbing with those two children in the woods. And it talks about not so much the Slender Man being a real haunting, but it talks about how we can create something and then trick ourselves into believing it and folding it into whatever culture, whatever historical kind of background story we have already in place. And it fits perfectly.
And I think Richard Dawkins is on that documentary talking about meme theory. And I think we listened to the trailer on a previous episode. It should be very good. Slender Man was made on a website called Something Awful and then went across to Creepypasta. And do you know, one of the most popular posts on my blog of all time is my one about the evolution of monsters. And it focuses on Slender Man in Cannock Chase, because Lee Brickley claimed that there are historic records of people seeing a tall creature in that area and in other areas too. Therefore, his conclusion was that Slender Man must predate the internet and can't be an online creation, completely missing the point that Slender Man, obviously I don't know for sure because I haven't spoken to the guy who made Slender Man, but probably took inspiration from folklore such as, you know, the boogeyman and other monsters and so on.
And he definitely did Blair Witch as well. There's, when you watch those initial videos, they are so Blair Witch like.
They are, yeah. And you know, if I think the reason that Slender Man was even dragged into the mix in Cannock Chase was because people reported waking up and seeing a tall figure in their room and they kind of described symptoms of sleep paralysis. And I pointed out in this blog post that if that had happened in America, they may very well have said that those creatures were not Slenderman, but aliens. And Lee Brickley has just spectacularly missed the point.
Yeah, it all becomes what is the sort of the cultural, the kind of cultural monster at the time. What is the thing which we fear most of all?
The monster du jour.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even historically in the UK, and across Europe, I expect, there are stories of like the Green Man and tall like fairy creatures.
Well, depending on when you experience something like sleep paralysis, because sleep paralysis has always been associated with the idea of a figure being in your room, and depending on when or where in history you were, you might think it was aliens, or you might think it was angels, you might think it was fairies. It all took on this shape of whatever was the terrifying thing at the time. I mean, it was, I think it's the hag that's really associated with sleep paralysis, which is essentially just a witch, isn't it? That it was, you know, part
yes,
of
that's right,
witch
yeah.
folklore. So depending on when and where in history you are, then it will...
It's absolutely fascinating to see how it all influences, even across such a span of time. You know, you've still got those early influences still playing a part in contemporary sightings, but then all you need is somebody like Lee Brickley or Damien Sim to be sat there going, oh, look at these conclusions I'm pulling out of my arse.
Yes.
Yeah, and the thing about the Pigman, Lee Brickley's Pigman, I think, is it's so specific that it feels like it could only be that specific because you created it. And the elements of it. Because the thing is, if Canik Chase was known for one thing, and it was consistently known for that one thing, whatever that was, I'd be far more interested. But frankly, it sounds like a supernatural circus. If you can think of what scares you, it's going to happen there. And that, just for me, comes from everything from, you know, the stories of murders there, the stories of people hiding in the woods, local legends. And, you know, parents warning their kids not to be out too late at night. It all folds itself in. And unfortunately, like, the more you add on, the more overstuffed it becomes. Yeah. And so you get to, like, Lee Brickley's Pigman, and it just becomes, all right, all you've done is added to it so you can jostle yourself into the history of that area. Well, my question there is, the Pigman, when did he come up with that theory? Because it sounds suspiciously like what happened in the first series of Doctor Who when it came back in 2005.
Let me aliens, just grab my copy, you know, of his book.
Because that was the thing. I remember reading that story and going, it sounds very familiar to Aliens of London, which is the mid-season two-parter of Doctor Who, you know, where they fake the crash landing and then stitched a pig's head onto a human body.
And there was also a pig man in the first series of American Horror Story as well. I remember that I think he wore a pig's head as a mask. But I think that would be more recent than I think the Canik story.
Yeah, I'm just reading through this book by Lee Brickley. It's just so terrible. I realise now why I was so harsh in my review, because I can't find the Pigman in here without properly going through it. But there's a section on top secret military activity, and basically one of the paragraphs reads like this. Okay, so, as a child, I remember hearing rumours about there being a nuclear war bunker underneath Canik Chase. In fact, having asked around over recent months, it seems that a lot of other people also heard those rumours, and many local residents even accept them as a viable truth. I remember this being a very tedious read.
It does. The whole of that book read like a very boring Reddit commenter. You know, it just felt... I don't know. The more I hear about it,
he's basically saying that they impregnated a woman with like a pig, and then she didn't actually she didn't show any sign of being pregnant, so they released her and then she gave birth, I think.
You know, that's very similar to, though. That's very similar to the Jersey Devil.
Oh, yes, it is. During my research into the Pigman, I received 3 solid sighting reports from members of the public that appeared to match the criteria for being genuine. What the fuck's the criteria for... The first was from a middle-aged couple who claimed that around 10 p.m. on an October evening in 1993, while walking their dog around the hill fort at Castle Ring, they spotted a strange-looking man in the distance, slowly
dogging,
slowly limping in their direction. He seemed to be wearing some kind of big pointy hat, but as they travelled nearer and the man moved from the darkness onto the moonlit path, they recalled the terrifying realisation that this was no ordinary man, describing him as having an oversized elongated head with a huge pointy ears and a pink snout-like nose protruding out from the centre of his evil-looking face. They fled the scene. The second account I was sent happened some 12 years later in the spring of 2005 when a lady cyclist allegedly encountered the creature of the same description. She wasn't spotted by the pigman, although the fear experience was certainly still as real and equally as distressing. The third and unquestionably the most astonishing claim came in to me from a 17-year-old student named John, probably John Smith, who in 2011 saw the pigman in two separate locations on the same night while driving around various car parks.
Yeah, dogging, you're right.
Yeah, dogging.
Case closed. Well, this has been another episode of the Spooktator podcast. Don't forget that you can find links to all of the things we discussed at spooktator.co.uk, where you'll also find the links to our social media accounts so that you can follow us there too. Now, before we go, does anybody have anything to share?
Yes, I have my weekly show on YouTube called Bartians, which I produce with Stuart Ashens and Barry Lewis. That happens every Friday. And the podcast that I do elsewhere where me and Eli talk about bargain bins, Cheap Show. You can go to thecheapshow.co.uk and listen to her two angry men swear a lot.
It is very good. You should listen to that.
Okay, well, I'm going to plug something. I'm going to plug something as well because I haven't in a while. I am going to go for my very first book, The Devil's Walk, which I think some people might enjoy. It's about the devil's footprints appearing in Devon in 1855. And it might be worth having a look into if anyone finds the story interesting.
I love that story. That's so cool.
It is just great, isn't it?
People
it
chasing
is
such a snow. Weren't they on rooftops and stuff as well?
Went over rooftops. It went for something like 150 miles around South Devon. It is a genuine bit of oddity in kind of English history that I just found myself getting very engrossed with. But it's mostly about sort of religious hysteria and the horribleness of being trapped in a small village in the middle of winter with no escape, essentially. So look into it if you feel like something a bit spooky and quite scientific-minded as well.
Well, if you send me a link, Charlie, I will post that on the notes page for this show.
Oh, that'd be very nice. Thank you.
I'd like to share an event that the London 14 Society have coming up in February, not because I'm involved in the group, which I'm not, but because it sounds really, really interesting. Scott Wood will deliver a talk called Killer Clowns, Moral Panic and Urban Myth on February 23rd at the Bell on Middlesex Street in London. The talk will look at the origins of the scares from the hoax to geysers to early mythical terrors such as Spring Hill Jack and the Chelsea Spiders. You can find the London 14 Society on Facebook and you can book tickets through the link on there. It sounds really interesting. We hope you'll join us again for the next episode in a month's time. But until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.